session number 13669, reel 2.
Mr. Miller, reel 2.
The Germans bombed or tried to bomb the bridge over the Dive, and we moved forward. And then we did a daylight attack towards the Falaise Gap. And we broke through this area. And I have never seen so much destruction. I didn't realise that the Germans had so much horse-drawn traffic as there was there, and the stench of dead animals and dead humans as we had to plough through this, going down just probably north of Falaise. And eventually we broke out and made down towards a town called Bernay. And I remember chasing down through this town. They were all waving to us as we were going through. We were trying to catch the Germans, and we didn't do so because we were not fast tanks. And eventually we reached the Seine. And at the Seine we had to wait until they built us a pontoon bridge across. And we crossed at a place called Pont de l'Arche, which is between Rouen and Paris. From there, we must have moved north, and the next thing I remember was we had various skirmishes. We were asked to help in the shelling of the Cap Grenet. We didn't actually see Cap Grenet, we were used as artillery for firing. We also were used on the outskirts of Calais, for the clearing of Calais. Again, we did very little action. But when it came to Boulogne, we led the attack into Boulogne.
What was that like?
Well, the previous hour or so, again, they had brought in Lancasters and then bombed it heavily. And the unfortunate thing about bombing is that it leaves massive craters and make it very difficult for track vehicles to get through. And the place that we were trying to get through, we couldn't get in, so we had to move left and try to get up there. Again, we were blocked, so the CO told me to get out of the tank and go up, and I went up with Captain Brown to see if we could get a clear route through. We got up on the top, and in the bomb crater there was a kangaroo with all its crew. And then suddenly some mortars opened up on us, and they caught us out in the open. We fell flat on our faces. Poor old Teddy Brown, my captain, had part of his foot blown away, so I had to help him down back. We ran back down to the tanks, and I reported to the CO, and off we set off, and Teddy Brown must have gone into casualty. And we get out on the top and then made our way down into Boulogne. We did not realise at the time that we had bypassed Mount Lambert on our left, which was still held by the Germans, and they were mortaring us down below. Later that was cleared, but probably a day later. And down we went to try to get down into the town. Again, the cratering was terrible, and I eventually ended up in a bomb crater down there. But our people got down and they actually took the town. So that was Boulogne.
Did you go right into the town?
I didn't go right into the town. No, I was overlooking the town. By the side of me, there was another massive bomb crater. At the bottom of this, there was a white flag waving. And we went down, and it was a bunker, a hospital bunker, with Germans in it. And we cleared that lot out. There was no trouble there at all.
How were they treated?
All right. The Canadians were there with us, you see, as well. Oh, yes, as far as I know, there was no ill treatment of prisoners. Don't forget, we were on the winning side now. From there, we must have moved north, and I think we must have gone to Blankenberg, ready for the Falkland affair. Blankenberg was still being shelled from the Zeebrugge end as we got in, but it was comparatively free. And there we started to prepare for the Falkland. I did not go on the Falkland affair, but some of our people went on it. From there, after the Falkland affair, we went past Brussels, through Ghent, past Brussels, and up into Holland, and we ended up near Eindhoven. And again, we were waiting there whilst the guards were in front of us, and they got up to Nijmegen and onto the Arnhem Island, trying to get to the bridge. There was very little we could do. Remember, we were really forward minesweeping troops, because we were fairly slow. We weren't fast-moving vehicles. The guards had Cromwells, which were cruiser tanks and fast. So it was much later that we went up to Nijmegen. And eventually, they asked us, this was after the Arnhem affair, and they pulled out from Arnhem. They asked my troop, we were detailed, to move forward and try to clear up through the island, up towards the bridge at Arnhem. By then, the Arnhem affair was finished. And I reached, well, I think we could see the bridge at Arnhem, and I was blown up. Remember, we had to go on forward until we hit something. It was no good flailing when there was nothing there. You had to go until something happened. And unfortunately, we hit mines, and that was just too bad. We had our tracks blown off. And my corporal was over on my right. His tracks were blown off. You were going to say?
Was anybody injured in the tank?
No, no. And the troop officer, who hadn't a flail, he had been in one of the command tanks behind without a flail, thought we were stalling, but we couldn't move. He came through between us, got through the minefield, jinked through it for some unknown reason, and then he decided to back onto it. And of course, what did he do? Hit a mine, blew up, and caught fire. At that moment, there was a bang on my left, a bazooka opened up on me, and my gun, my 75mm, jammed, so I had to climb out on the top and use the machine gun on the top, on the Germans having a go at me on the left. Anyway, we got out of it all right, without any bother.
Could you see the enemy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You could see individuals, could you?
You could see the individuals, oh, yes. And they ran off onto our left into a strong point on the left. And as soon as I got my gun out of the jam, we gave it the 75er. That was that. And we cleared that lot out. So, in every case, whenever this happened, you had to have your recovery people come up from behind you when you cleared the area. And, of course, we ran back on our tank tracks because we knew we were safe going back through the minefield. And that was that. But you can't remember the individual little things that happened afterwards. It was the big things that you remember. From there, where did we go?
In the tank, who operated the flails themselves?
The driver, co-driver in the front. We had a driver and a co-driver. And the co-driver would put in the flails. I would order him to flail. And he would flail it, either the driver or the co-driver, because it was geared from the engine. Right? Soon after this, the Ardennes affair started. Now, we had moved down to somewhere near Maastricht at that time, because we were going to break out through the Siegfried Line. And then, of course, the Ardennes affair blew up. So we had to hold the northern part in case the Germans turned north. And there we stayed. And there we stayed until, oh, I should think it must have been after Christmas, 1944.
In the Maastricht area?
In the Maastricht area. And we ended up at a place, they pulled us out eventually in the new year to give us a break, to a place called Geleen. And Geleen had what was known as, what was it called? The Staatsmine Morris. It must have been a big coal mine. And there we used their showers because we'd been out for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, without any change. And then they gave us a break there. They gave us a break for about a few days because by then the Ardennes affair was over, finished. And then in the January, and it was bitterly cold. Snow and ice and frost, and they then took us down again near Maastricht to do what we were going to do before, to break out. And our job was to take Heinsberg, which was in the Siegfried Line. And again we had a night attack, and we had had, we must have been in Germany, because I remember we went into this German farmhouse and we ransacked it for sheets to cover the tanks as camouflage, because we're in the snow. And we used these sheets as camouflage. And that night we went down, again we were leading in case we bumped into mines. No mines, we just kept trundling on, and eventually we got into Heinsberg. And there was a hell of an explosion as we got in. And this was in the dark, early morning. And it was a weasel. It must have hit a mine on our left. And still, it was eerie silence, apart from this terrific explosion. And we got in, and it must have been about 7 o'clock in the morning. Suddenly, the heavens opened, and the Germans opened up on us. They got us into the town, and they really did not belt us, shelling. And there we stayed all day. And we were warned there was a tiger lurking round. We couldn't do anything about a tiger. With our 75s, you couldn't touch them. You needed a 17-pounder to touch the tigers. But we didn't see him. And eventually, things eased up. And later in the day, we pulled out from Heinsberg. We'd taken Heinsberg. And we pulled back. Now then, from there, where did we go? I can't remember much of what happened. But we must have gone forward into Germany. And then myself and one of my corporals were sent off on a 48-hour break to Brussels. And when we arrived back, the squadron leader said, well, we're going into attack with the Americans tonight. We're breaking out through towards the Rhine, onto the Rhine plain. And we're leading the attack. He said, I'm putting MacArthur in to take your place. He's had no battle experience. It'll do him good. And so off they went, my troop, off they went. A few hours later, wireless back to say my troop had just about been wiped out. They had been leading the Americans. The Americans were well behind. And unfortunately, in the dark, the Americans had taken us for tigers, and they shot us up from behind. And 12 of my 20 lads were killed, including the chappie who'd taken my place and my wireless operator in the bottom of the tank. When I got up to them, the man who had taken my place, had his head blown off. And my wireless operator was dead in the bottom of the tank. The gunner was badly wounded. They'd taken him off to hospital. But, again, the accidents of war. And apparently one of the reasons was that we were not on wireless net with the Americans, which was not good. From there again, I can't remember much that happened apart from when we crossed the Rhine. And we crossed the Rhine at Emmerich. They had to build a pontoon bridge to get us across. And Emmerich was absolutely flattened. When we got over the Rhine at Emmerich, we turned left and we were told we were going across to Arnhem to clear Arnhem, which we did. We then crossed over the Yssel and went into Arnhem. Arnhem was reasonably quiet. We hadn't too much trouble until we got into the middle, and near Arnhem Flats, we were standing around there when the flats went up in flames, so they must have left booby traps or something in these places where whoever had been in there before.
Some block of flats?
A block of flats. Arnhem Flats it was. When we cleared Arnhem, we went north to a place called Velop and cleared that. The Germans had put charges on the trees and dropped the trees across the road there, but we got through to Velop, and then we moved down to where the parachute people had trouble several months before, and we cleared Oosterbeek, and I did some mine sweeping at Renkum. I cleared my tank crew out, and I just used the driver and myself, and you know, we flailed on these block roads they were, and to explode the mines.
How effective were the flail tanks in clearing mines?
Oh, they were good. They were good. Occasionally you'd miss something, but in general it did its job. Oh yes, and scared the daylights out of the Germans when they saw them coming. Saw these things flushing round.
Because they didn't know what they were.
They didn't know what they were. No. I mean, the first time they hit them, they wondered what had hit them. Although we didn't do them much damage, it was the psychological effect. Just as it was with the flamethrowers, our big flamethrowers. They absolutely scared the daylights out of them. So we cleared Arnhem, and then we moved up to Apeldoorn, and the war finished when we reached Apeldoorn. And there we had to stay because the Germans threatened to blow the dikes, and we didn't want to flood Western Holland, so we had to more or less stay there until eventually the VE Day came. And that was the end of the war for me, apart from the fact they took in my pay book, and they marked on it Far East 1, so I thought, well, here we are, off we go again.
How did you view the prospect of fighting the Japanese?
I didn't. We thought we'd had enough. The thing that struck in my mind, and I think that in most of our minds then, was we could never relax, because we always felt we were forward troops and we were going to call in to do something. Oh, I forgot to tell you, on one occasion we were somewhere in the Aachen area, and there we had to, again, we were called up by army troops. The Americans, I forget which it was, the 1st or the 9th Army, called us in to do some flailing because it was the ground was frozen, and we went in to a place called Verslum, just down the outskirts of Aachen, and they wanted us to flail a pass through this minefield that it struck, which we did. but it was ground was so hard that the flails were not as effective as they were. And again, I was blown up there. But it wasn't serious, except in the fact that it blew your tracks off. And you know, by military, you're finished. You couldn't move forward. So the recovery people had to come from behind you, pull you out and put your tracks on again.
But what effect does it have on the morale of the crew to be blown up?
Well, I don't think it was serious, really. No, the only thing that we were worried about was that sometimes we thought that the Germans would be clever enough to put a delayed action fuse on and blow up under the belly of the tank, because the belly of the tank was the most vulnerable part of a tank. But as far as I know, it didn't happen.
What was the most feared German weaponry as far as being in a flail tank was concerned?
88. The 88. You see, we had not enough armour for a start. We had not enough gunpowder. We had to rely on other people to support us because we were going in blind. And we didn't have a big enough gun. And I think that must have been in the British Army. The 88 was a fearsome weapon as far as we were concerned. And until we got, well, we had our, you know, the big AKAK gun was a good one of ours. I think it was the 3.7. And that was a good one, the British one. And then we had the 17-pounder. But we were not armed with these guns ourselves. Therefore, we couldn't fight back.
How often did you come across the German Panther and Tiger tanks?
No, you frequently saw them, but they'd been knocked out by the time we got them. I mean, they were about. The day that I was telling you that my troop was decimated, I was told to go and have a look at my tanks. And I went to a village called Steinstrasse. I came round a corner, and I've never seen such a tank in my life, a German tank. I've never seen it since. And it was a huge mortar, and the actual barrel of the mortar must have been about a yard across it. It was colossal. I've never seen such a tank. But this is Germans, the way the Germans worked. If it ever did any good, I don't know. Right?
Yes, you said after Apeldoorn.
Yes, after Apeldoorn, it was stalemate as far as we were concerned. And eventually I came back to England. They sent me back on a course to Chobham, I think it was, on a course. And then after that I had a week's leave and I got married. I returned to Europe. When I arrived back, I was told my unit were up at Hoya on the Weser, south of Bremen. So I went up to there, and they disappeared. I was sent back to Osnabrück, and eventually I found them in the Harz Mountains. And there we met up with the Russians.
What impression?
And they were little. They were Mongolians, little, slit-eyed Mongolians. And that was the sort of border then. And this is when the division took place between East and West Germany.
Did you have much to do with the Russians?
No.
What impression did they make on you?
Well, I really didn't have much to do with them. But what I was surprised about when I got down there, because the war had then been finished for a few weeks was that I still felt there was some German resistance, even in the Harz Mountain area. I still felt there was something there.
What made you feel that?
The attitude of the population in that area. I felt they were still the real Nazi types, and probably the war had not affected them in that area. I think they were still prepared to fight. And that was my ending of the war, really, in the Braunlager area.